Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Mattei. Thanks so much for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. And today we have a classic Useful Idiots double feature, Break Out the Popcorn. Not one, but two interviews on two vital topics. Of course, the moral issue of our time, Palestine, the Gaza genocide, people returning to what's left of their homes. And we're going to hear from the Gazan-born poet who now lives in the U.S., Masab Abu Toha. And we're going to be talking about DeepSeek. What is it? Is it a threat to us? Should we be scared of this new Chinese AI technology that has people freaking out? And we'll be talking about that and a lot of other related issues when it comes to our tech overlords.
Both great discussions. Spoiler alert. And as always, please do support us at usefulidiotspodcast.com because there you get bonus content, including extensive interviews and the fabulous Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. Let's start with the four basic food groups. What do we got for Democrats suck, Aaron?
For Democrats suck, we're going to turn to the confirmation hearing of Tulsi Gabbard, who is a former Democrat but left the party after she was smeared for calling out the corruption of the DNC and rigging the primary in 2016 against Bernie Sanders. She was also smeared for some of her views on foreign policy with people, including Hillary Clinton, calling her a Russian asset. And since then, she's rebranded, she's joined MAGA, and Trump has tapped her to oversee the nation's intelligence agencies. And to get that nomination, Tulsi Gabbard has abandoned some of her past views. She used to speak, and I think for Washington's standards, a pretty fair-minded way about Palestine. Since then, she's become an arch-Zionist, although always her record on that was a little bit checkered. Yeah. She was hanging out with Shmuley Botiak a long time ago. But yeah. In more recent years, when she was running for the Democratic Party nomination, I thought she was saying some decent things when it comes to Palestine, but that's no more. She's abandoned that. But she's kept some of her views that have gotten her a lot of detractors when it comes to foreign policy, including criticizing the proxy wars in Syria and Ukraine, which in Washington, if you want to be part of the intelligence establishment, you simply cannot do, because these are major foreign wars that the U.S. has been fueling for a very, very long time. And people in power on both parties have not liked the things that she's been saying. And one of them, which she pointed out in her opening statement, and I think this just shows the bankruptcy of Democrats in some of their foreign policy views, is pointing out that in Syria, the U.S. supported an insurgency that it knew was dominated by al-Qaeda.
As Jake Sullivan said to Hillary Clinton, quote, al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. Well, Syria is now controlled by an al-Qaeda offshoot.
So how often do you ever hear that mentioned in a congressional setting? Someone acknowledging that the U.S. supported an al-Qaeda-dominated insurgency to the point where Jake Sullivan wrote, al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. And it's for comments like that that Tulsi Gabbard attracts so much hostility from both parties, but now especially Democrats, because the dirty war in Syria, that was their project. It began under Obama, although the Bush administration set the roots for it. And so Tulsi Gabbard said that. And comments like this have made some strong enemies for Tulsi Gabbard on the Democratic side. Among them, Michael Bennett, who was yelling at Tulsi Gabbard throughout her confirmation hearing, multiple times asking Tulsi Gabbard to declare that Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, is a traitor. And Tulsi Gabbard, who previously called for pardoning Snowden, would not oblige. And he was very, very livid about that. He also was very livid that Tulsi Gabbard has criticized U.S. policy in Ukraine and has said that the U.S. could have helped avoid the war by addressing Russian security concerns. So here is Michael Bennett taking Tulsi Gabbard to task for daring to say that the U.S. helped provoke the Ukraine war.
February 23rd, 2022, at the very moment that Russian tanks were rolling across the peaceful border of Ukraine for the first time, you tweeted at 11:30 p.m. your time, this war and suffering could have easily been avoided if Biden administration/NATO had simply acknowledged Russia's legitimate legitimate security concerns regarding Ukraine's becoming a member of NATO. Did you say that, yes or no?
I believe you're reading my tweet, Senator.
Yes is the answer.
So Michael Bennett is indignant that Tulsi Gabbard tweeted, and he really emphasized that, you tweeted this, how dare you, that
Russia had, at 11:30
p.m., that Russia had legitimate security concerns. How dare someone say that? He was so upset by this that in his closing remarks, he focused on it again.
Can't we do better than somebody who doesn't believe in 702? Can't we believe that somebody who can't answer whether Snowden was a traitor five times today, who made excuses for Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, the first time that I'm aware of any American official has done that? I'm questioning her judgment. That's the issue that's at stake here.
So let me correct Senator Bennett here, where he says, this is the first time I believe an American official has ever said that Russia has legitimate security concerns, and how dare Tulsi Gabbard? That's not true. One of the people who's made this point before Tulsi Gabbard is Charles Kupchan. He is a former senior official on Barack Obama's National Security Council. Barack Obama, a fellow Democrat, just like Michael Bennett. And listen to what Charles Kupchan said, exactly sounding like Tulsi Gabbard. Russia has legitimate security concerns about NATO setting up shop on the other side of its 1,000-mile-plus border with Ukraine. NATO may be a defensive alliance, but it brings to bear aggregate military power that Moscow understandably does not want parked near its territory. So Tulsi Gabbard is far from the first to acknowledge what's obvious to anybody with their eyes open, that yeah, Russia does have legitimate security concerns, just as the U.S. would have legitimate security concerns if Russia was trying to bring Mexico or Canada into a hostile military alliance. And Charles Kupchan said there exactly what Tulsi Gabbard said. But Michael Bennett, who is a part of this Democratic trend of just being fully aligned with neocons who start in the Republican Party under the Bush administration in that camp, he can't process that thought and had a total freak out about it today. Another issue that engendered a freak out was Tulsi Gabbard being skeptical of allegations that the former Syrian government under Assad used chemical weapons. And Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona pressed Tulsi Gabbard on that.
Can you explain to me then why you doubted the intelligence community's conclusions in these two cases, Duma and Khan Sheikhoun, but not the others? And please be specific.
These two cases were being looked at as to be used as a pretext for a major military movement. And my fear was a repeat of the deployment of another 500,000 soldiers like we saw in Iraq towards what was the Obama administration's goal, which was regime change in Syria. The question specifically that I raised around these two came about because there were two reasons. One, that assessment was made with high confidence and low information. The information that they had came from those on the ground in an Al-Qaeda-controlled area and therefore were Al-Qaeda-linked sources. And there was conflicting information that came from the UN's Office on the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons Inspectors, as well as an MIT professor, Ted Postol,
so who looked at these
extensively.
So
what we heard there is, for the first time in a formal U.S. government setting, somebody mentioning the OPCW whistleblowers who challenged the cover-up of their investigation in Duma, one of the cases Gabbard's talking about, because their findings undermined the allegation lodged by the Trump administration that Syria committed a chemical attack in Duma, and those findings were censored. And this is a story I've covered extensively. It's based on leaked OPCW documents. This is the first time that I can recall that's ever been mentioned in a formal U.S. government setting. So this is a milestone for accountability, because finally the OPCW whistleblowers and their leaks are being acknowledged. And Senator Mark Kelly tried to make this an issue at the hearing, but he did not have a rebuttal for Tulsi Gabbard repeatedly mentioning the OPCW whistleblowers, because they're right. And that's why they get ignored by people like Mark Kelly and the entire U.S. media, who never even acknowledge the OPCW whistleblowers' existence, because the whistleblowers and the leaks that contain evidence of what actually was found in Duma undermine this widespread narrative, which is used to justify military strikes on Syria and murderous sanctions. They undermine the narrative that Assad used chemical weapons in Duma. And that's why our reliable media stenographers go along with it. So Tulsi Gabbard pierced that propaganda bubble And Mark Kelly had no response to it. So I thought that was a really important moment. And he's also, by the way, repeating a mistake. He says that Tulsi Gabbard has challenged U.S. intelligence assessments. In all the cases where Tulsi Gabbard has raised questions about U.S. allegations that Assad used chemical weapons, the intelligence community has never released a formal assessment that makes the case. The White House has put out press releases that they say is based on U.S. intelligence, but these documents don't have the imprint of U.S. intelligence. The first one was put out by Ben Rhodes, who was a creative writing MFA under Obama, and Rhodes later admitted to feeling anxiety writing it. And that's because the intelligence community refused to put out their own assessment accusing Assad, because James Clapper, whose job Tulsi Gabbard is now up for, went to Obama and said, the case against Assad is not a slam dunk, which was a deliberate reference to the Iraq WMD hoax. So Mark Kelly is basically challenging and excoriating Tulsi Gabbard, not for questioning even U.S. intelligence, but for questioning White House press releases written by non-intelligence officials trying to make the case for bombing Syria. And because Tulsi Gabbard didn't go along with that, and in fact echoed the position of James Clapper when he refused to put the intelligence community's name on a statement accusing Assad, now she's being pilloried. But do we want people who are blindly believing pro-war claims or applying proper skepticism? And so personally, I think Tulsi Gabbard's skepticism is a virtue, but not a liability.
So it sounds like Michael Bennett needs to be grilled, just like he grilled Tulsi Gabbard. He should be asked, is it true that you said that Tulsi Gabbard was the first person to say that Vladimir Putin had legitimate security concerns vis-a-vis NATO? He should be grilled on that, and they should read out like the transcript and also the time he said it, because apparently that's important, like that she tweeted out at 11:30. I wonder if he's trying to link her to Trump, because I guess Trump and Neera Tanden were famous for their late night tweets. And similarly, it seems like the claim that someone was the first to do something was not Tulsi Gabbard when it came to understanding Russia's security concerns. It perhaps was Tulsi Gabbard in bringing up the OPCW.
That's correct. That was a landmark moment. Again, no one's ever done that before. If you read any media account of the issue of Syria, chemical weapons, OPCW, they never, ever acknowledge OPCW whistleblowers, because acknowledging their existence means you have to contend with their findings, which were censored. And that's just too damning to the narrative that Syria used chemical weapons in Douma. So therefore, they just get ignored. It's the most whitewashed, yeah, Orwellian funny story I've ever seen. It's just, and it persists after all these years. Like, we know now that the Iraq WMD hoax is a hoax, but on the issue of Syria chemical weapons, you would not know that the world's top chemical weapons watchdog, if you read the New York Times or Washington Post or watch CNN or MSNBC, you would not know that whistleblowers challenged the cover up of their investigation after it undermined the claim that Assad used chemical weapons in Douma.
Well, speaking of Republican sucking and also the great WMD hoax, let's take a look at a screenshot that I actually took of MSNBC. This is Nicole Wallace, who is indeed a Republican. She's just a never Trumper. And she was talking about Trump taking away people's security clearances. And she said that that was especially dangerous because apparently Iran is trying to kill some people. And here is what she cited as a source for that claim. Okay, so she cites an article in Tablet. It's called Iran is Still Trying to Kill American Officials. And this is an article by Judith Miller. And what's so ironic about this is that Judith Miller, of course, is famous for spreading the WMD propaganda. She really did a lot to sell the Iraq war. And she was kind of Bush's go-to person. And she's gone very much to the right. And sucked before she really went to the right. But yes, she used to be at the New York Times. And now she's at some really right-wing fringe outlet / Tablet. So it's nice to see the lessons that Republicans have learned, which is that you can still go back to Judith Miller as a credible source, even though that should be embarrassing. But another Republican who sucked is Tom Cotton. And this is something he said when he was presiding over the Tulsi Gabbard confirmation hearings. It's kind of a nice moment of honesty. Let's take a listen.
In a fallen world, we have to take our friends where we find them. No question, stable democracies make the most stable friends. But what matters in the end is less whether a country is democratic or non-democratic, and more whether the country is pro-American or anti-American. I'll confess that those views may be somewhat unconventional, but look at where conventional thinking has got us.
Again, this could be, you know, we often play the who said it, Trump or Chomsky. Well, this could be another game, who said it, Tom Cotton or Chomsky, where they are making a similar point, although the takeaways are, of course, very different. Because for Chomsky, the fact that America bases its friendships on how pro-American a government is as opposed to how democratic a government is, that's a bad thing. For Tom Cotton, it's just a way of the world.
It reminds me of when the Biden administration would say, we're in Ukraine flooding with weapons to defend democracy. And Mitch McConnell came out and said, no, that's not why. It's just these are cold, hard American interests, because investing in Ukraine means we're investing in weakening our adversary, which is the more honest answer. And Tom Cotton coming through with that patented Republican honesty about how we run the world. And so therefore, we don't care about democracy. We just care about whether they're with us or against us, just like George W. Bush said.
And got to give you some more Republican suck. And this time we got to focus on how much Trump sucks. So as part of his anti-immigration executive order spree, he has a new and old barbaric threat against people searching for a better life. And he's going to be trying to at least create a 30,000 person migrant facility at Guantanamo Bay. And in case that wasn't disgusting enough, Donald Trump also issued an executive order to deport non-citizen college students and other international visitors who take part in pro-Palestinian protests, or as Trump called it, I will quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radicalism like never before. So, of course, for Trump, that is code. Pro-Hamas is code for people who have ideas like we should stop killing Palestinians, or, you know, there should be a ceasefire, or we should stop sending bombs. Those are the villains that he can potentially deport.
And this is the same guy who ran on, we're going to stop government censorship. The Democrats are overreaching, preventing people from expressing their freedom of expression. And there he goes. And he vows to crack down on people's freedom of expression when it comes to the moral issue of our time, Palestine.
Yeah. Thank you, Trump.
All right, for isn't that weird, I want to turn to the now former CNN anchor, Jim Acosta. Jim Acosta wrote a book during the first Trump administration about how hard it is to be a journalist in Trump's America. There's a picture on the cover of like him and Trump sparring. The message was, I'm Jim Acosta and I'm so brave for challenging Donald Trump. Of course, Jim Acosta doesn't care about actual dissidents like Edward Snowden or Julian Assange. He was saying all this as Julian Assange was like rotting in prison under the Trump administration at their behest. So anyway, but Jim Acosta recently is among the people at CNN who have turned over because CNN is losing its ratings because no one trusts it anymore. No one watches. So Jim Acosta was offered by CNN a midnight slot, which is kind of the graveyard shift in cable news. And he declined to take the midnight slot at CNN. So he bid farewell to his audience. And this was part of his parting message.
One final message. Don't give in to the lies. Don't give in to the fear. Hold on to the truth and to hope. Even if you have to get out your phone, record that message. I will not give in to the lies. I will not give in to the fear. Post it on your social media so people can hear from you too.
So Jim Acosta urging his audience to record social media videos of themselves saying, I will not give in to the lies. I will not give in to the fear. Katie, did you happen to see anybody on your social media feed heeding Jim Acosta's call and releasing a video of themselves repeating that line?
No, but I think because it's too heavy of a lift and it's too risky. People are afraid to do it. Yeah.
That they might get rounded up in prison.
It requires too much bravery.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for some reason, Jim Acosta's rallying call just didn't catch on. I didn't see it become a trend for people to record. I will not give in to lies. I will not give in to the fear. But funnily enough, it reminded me of a scene from one of my favorite films, Network, which came out in 1976. It's a searing just look at the role of corporate media in our society, in our decaying society. And, you know, it's centered on an anchor who sort of loses his mind a little bit, but becomes like a folk hero because he's channeling all this anti-establishment sentiment. And even though he channels it into kind of like nothing substantive, just his outrage is enough to basically spark a whole new trend. And so this is a bit of a scene from Network. And I'm wondering if Jim Acosta, wittingly or not, drew any inspiration from this.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up. Go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
So there we go. I wonder if Jim Acosta was inspired by that. And certainly in the movie, then people start doing that. They start yelling, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. It becomes like a national trend. Jim Acosta's line did not catch on, but I appreciate his effort.
Yeah.
And I just love the overlap there with Network.
I mean, maybe he's kind of like that guy. If that guy had taken a bunch of Ambien, that would be the equivalent of Jim Acosta. And, you know, we should clarify, it's not just that he kind of like didn't mention Julian Assange. He was asked pointedly if he would defend him and his right to justice, and if he would defend free press and freedom of press and the First Amendment. And he like explicitly refused to do so. And there's footage of that. Very damning footage of that.
Well, Jim Acosta, this one's for you. I will not give in to the lies. I will not give in to the fear.
Yeah. So for, isn't that terrible? There is obviously this very terrible plane crash that happened in Washington, D.C. That's terrible in itself. But perhaps contributing to this terribleness is the take coming from people on the right about what the cause of this plane crash was. So let's hear from Congressman Andy Ogles.
Is there any reason to believe there was any foul play here?
Well, you know, at this time, you hate to jump to any conclusions. Obviously, we'll look at everything, check all the boxes. You know, I had just taken off from D.C. Before the crash. Of course, it came across my cell phone and I saw it and was horrified. So prayers go out to all those impacted. But, you know, to your point, I think you have to look at this with eyes wide open, see what happened. You know, human error. Was it some sort of equipment failure? Did DEI play a role in this type of thing? So I think you look at it, you go into it with, again, eyes wide open and make sure that something like this never happens. It's been a number of years since we've had an aircraft collision such as this. And so, again, prayers for all those impacted.
Absolutely.
So there you have it. It's DEI. I mean, you could also look at the fact that, for instance, Trump recently fired the head of the Transportation Security Administration and all members of the Aviation Security Advisory Committee. But you could also pretend that it's because of diversity, I guess. I mean, there's never any evidence of that, but they certainly like to use that as kind of the boogeyman.
Yeah, every single time there's a problem. It's like when Democrats would limit everything on Russia.
Yeah.
Similar thing with Republicans. And now everything is the fault of diversity. They both need group therapy, like de-radicalization, just this habit to blame groups. In the Republican case, especially marginalized groups, for horrible tragedies like this one.
And often, as we pointed out on last week's Thursday Throwdown, this is often this kind of like anti-DI, anti-woke framing is often used to cut public funding. So don't be fooled by it. That's often behind the kind of coordinated narratives. You know, the weaponized and woke government, we're going to be seeing a lot more of that as Trump chips away, or not even chips away, like bulldozes through whatever welfare state does exist.
And those have been your four basic food groups.
So we have two interviews for you today. Very excited. Our first one is Mosab Abu Toha, who's a Palestinian poet, short story writer, and essayist from Gaza. Abu Toha is also the founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, which was just destroyed by Israel, as we get into. And he recently won an Overseas Press Club Award for his Letter from Gaza columns for The New Yorker. His new poetry book is Forest of Noise. Mosab Abu Toha, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you, Katie and Aaron.
So I want to start off by asking you your thoughts on the ceasefire agreement. And is this really a ceasefire?
Well, they call it a ceasefire, but the fire hasn't ceased, at least in Palestine, in the West Bank. Just yesterday, 10 people were killed. And so many others were killed even after the ceasefire came into force in Gaza. About 12 days ago. And the ceasefire is not everything, because so many people are still missing. The Palestinian Civil Defense Forces are still unearthing mass graves. So there is no talk about ceasefire when we are still uncovering the dead bodies of so many people who we assumed were still alive. And I can't think of calling this a real ceasefire if people are still living in the open. And I mean, no tents have entered Gaza, no makeshift housing units have been entered into Gaza. People are unable to leave, unable to return to Gaza. The wounded, the critically wounded people have been unable to leave Gaza. So, I mean, not opening fire at someone, it doesn't mean that they have stopped bleeding or that they are not being wounded by other things around them that the occupation has left behind.
You posted a pretty devastating poem, which I'd love it if you could read it. And then I want to ask you what the return of the refugees means and if you're hopeful about the future.
Gaza has become a funeral home, but there are no seats. No mourners, no bodies. In the caskets are nothing but what remained of the dead's clothes. And on the crumbling walls are clocks that have not moved for 14 months. As you can tell from the poem, this poem was written 2 months ago. And it's about Gaza. I have lost 31 members of my father's cousin's family. I mean, my father's cousin was killed with his wife, with his children, and with his grandchildren. And one of the murdered people was a first cousin of mine, and I wasn't able to see her body or to bid her farewell, her husband, her children. So it's a big Gaza. All of Gaza has become a funeral home. But I mean, there are no mourners because the mourners themselves are killed. So who is going to mourn the death of someone when the father, the mother, the sibling of that person were killed? And even if neighbors were coming to mourn and to offer their condolences to someone, I mean, they could be killed in the street, as it happened to so many people. And sometimes we do the funeral on the phone. We say, we call someone and say, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. And then a few minutes later, that person, the caller or the recipient of this condolences, would be killed. So the whole of Gaza has become like a home where everyone is saying or bidding farewell to someone when this person who is offering the farewell knows that he could be killed, he could be next. So the poem also talks about the so many people who, after they were killed, they were left in the street or under the rubble of their houses, and the family, when they return, if they were able to, would find only a few bones. I mean, you go to social media and see, I hate to say that. When the numbers of the people who are killed are reported, they say according to Gaza Ministry of Health or Hamas. It's not Hamas, it's not Gaza, it's not even Gaza's Ministry of Health who is telling us the numbers. It's me. I tell you that I lost 31 members of my family. My neighbor tells me that he lost his uncle and his wife and their children. So it's not Hamas. It's not. I don't care about Hamas. I don't care about Gaza's Ministry of Health. It's me who is killed, and I'm telling you this. So this poem tells you that the people who not only were killed, but we were able to just to bury a bone or two or a skull, you know, and even without us being able to identify who that boy or who that girl or who that father was. I mean, that poem was written 2 months ago, and we are still watching videos and seeing pictures of people who were just found in areas that no one could approach in Gaza.
Mossab, talk to us about the Edward Said Library that you established in Gaza. What happened to it?
For so long, Israel has been attacking every place in Gaza. Universities, we know that Israel destroyed all universities in Gaza, many, many schools, you know, including the schools where I taught, where my children went before October 7th. Israel.
It's a new year, we've got a new administration, and with the way things are changing, it's getting harder and harder to predict what the world will look like even tomorrow. Which is why we searched the whole world to find one thing that we can dependently rely on, and we found it at American Giant. They're making high quality, long lasting clothes that never go out of style. As presidents come and go, as years go by, and as seasons change, your clothes won't have to. Born from a commitment to support the communities that create its products, every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. American Giant makes staples that are anything but basic. Try their classic full-zip hoodie, which Slate magazine called the greatest hoodie ever made. You can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Or the premium Slub Crew Tee, no BS high-rise pant, and slim roughneck pant featured in Giant magazine issue 2. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Destroyed so many cultural centers, and the Edward Said Public Library. I mean, I'm not struck. I'm not surprised that it was destroyed, because it's not the only thing that was destroyed. So many lives have been destroyed. So many buildings have been destroyed. So many hospitals have been destroyed. But I mean, the special thing about the Edward Said Public Library that I founded with the help of so many friends, especially in the West. Just imagine, in the West. So we get support from beautiful people in the West, but at the same time, we are getting bombs from people in the West. So I was able to establish a public library, especially an English language library, where we had on the shelves the, you know, every book that you can think of, novels, history books, poetry collections, sometimes poems that were signed by authors who are living in the US or in Europe. So I really struggled to build this library, and this library, thankfully, became two branches, one in Beit Lahia in North Gaza, where I lived for the past 20 so years, and then in Gaza City. The hard thing about building something in Gaza, not to say a library, is that Israel has been imposing a draconian siege on the Gaza Strip, where you can't get a gift from a friend from outside of Gaza. If you are getting some kind of a gift from a friend, it will go through Israel, and Israel will decide whether this package will enter Gaza or not. So when I was collecting the books, when I was building the library, each box of books that entered Gaza for the library or for myself took about 8 weeks to make the journey into the bookshelves at the Edward Said Public Library. So just imagine the 2,000 or 4,000 books that I collected over the past 7 years. Just imagine how long it took. Now, we can start to imagine how long it would take to build houses, to build universities, to build schools, to build a library, and how long it will take to put and receive books from outside of Gaza, and how long it will take. I mean, people to start thinking about visiting a library, especially the children, many of whom have been amputated, many of whom have lost their parents or their siblings. I mean, so Israel destroyed so much. And this is why I think that this is more than a genocide, because this is an irrecoverable destruction.
And so from friends of yours, loved ones that are returning now to what's left of their homes, what are you hearing from them?
Oh, I mean, just yesterday I was able to talk to my youngest sister, mother of a girl who was 3 months old on October 7th. I mean, to be honest, I asked her how now she's living in a tent in Beit Lahia. And she shocked me when she said, "I wish I died. I prefer to have died to live in a tent now, even after a ceasefire." And this is my sister. She said, "I wished I died. I was killed in an airstrike or something." I mean, not because people in Gaza want to die, but because the circumstances that they are living through, they are killing. These circumstances are killing people silently and slowly. this is one thing. Today, I was in touch with a friend of mine who teaches Arabic. He's from North Gaza, and he's a father of two children. And he wrote to me today, just a few minutes before this call. He said, I went to North Gaza for 2 days. Now I'm back in the south. He's now back in his tent where he used to live for the past 16 months. Why? Because there is nothing in North Gaza. Not only that there are no houses in North Gaza, but there is no water. It's even impossible for him to move his tent from South Gaza to North Gaza. Why? Not only because there is no transportation like cars, because Israel is limiting the amount of fuel that is coming to Gaza. Israel is searching everything. It's very, very slow. And he has two children to take care of. So not only that, but because there is no place for him to place the tent on. He used to live on, I think, maybe the fourth or fifth floor of a residential building. And the whole area is a pile of rubble. So where do you place your tent? So people are returning to South Gaza. They were very happy, and I saw the pictures and videos. People were very happy to run once the ceasefire was announced. People were running. I mean, you know how long it takes you to walk from south to North Gaza? 5 hours. He walked for 5 hours from south to southern to North Gaza, and today he took the trip back to North Gaza. And he didn't take his wife and children with him, because when he returned to North Gaza, he wanted to just see how things are, whether he could, you know, bring his wife and children to live in Beit Lahia. But he decided to go back. But going back for what and for how long? No one knows. This is why it's not a ceasefire.
And by the way, my deepest condolences to you and your family and friends. And what your sister said is haunting. I was wondering how you and the people you're in touch with see the election of Donald Trump, because a lot of people are looking at the images of what's happening in Gaza and saying stuff like, I hope you guys are happy for, you know, sabotaging Kamala Harris's campaign, in reference to people who couldn't bring themselves to vote for Kamala Harris, who either stayed home or voted third party. Now, a lot of these people who are speaking out now weren't speaking out about Gaza before Trump's election. But what are your thoughts on this?
I'm not American. I didn't live in America for long. And I think this is an American issue. But at the same time, it is a global issue, because whoever comes to power in America would decide the fate of so many people who live thousands of miles away from America. So I think the reason Trump won the election was not only because of Gaza. I mean, now I think many people blame, you know, Gaza to be the main reason. I don't think it's the main reason, but it's one of the big reasons why people saw that Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party must not win. But it doesn't mean that Trump's winning would serve Gaza or Palestine or even the whole world any better. Now with Trump's executive orders, people feel like they are regretting not having Kamala Harris in place, you know? So now you have someone who is doing something bad, and then you blame them for the bad things that are happening in your country. Then someone who is worse than that bad person comes, and you say, and you are expected to say that, oh, we wish that bad person stayed, you know? So now we come to say, oh, the Biden administration was better than Donald Trump. You know, so for me, none of them serves the interest of anyone in Palestine, not in the world. I think that the Democratic Party is letting the genocide in Gaza continue and fueling it by sending more and more weapons and vetoing so many times a ceasefire resolution. And also repeating, I mean, this is one thing, repeating the lies that Israel has been spreading about raping, about beheading babies, burning babies, about Hamas being, you know, everyone in Gaza being Hamas. No, not everyone in Gaza is Hamas. Not before October 7th and not after October 7th. You know, the Palestinian people are diverse people. You have people who hate Hamas. You have people who love Hamas. Like you have people who love Trump here who hate Trump, you know? So it's, I mean, we are a people. We differ on so many topics. So I think now people who voted for Trump, especially maybe some Arabs, some Muslims who voted for Trump, now realize how catastrophic that was, because he is now, you know, issuing many orders that are affecting everyone, not only Muslims and Arabs, but everyone. You know, the freedom of speech. Students who protested the genocide in Gaza are named jihadis, you know, are named pro-Hamas. So this is a very dangerous episode in the, not only in America, but in the whole world. One last thing I wanted to say was that the people Trump appointed, I mean, one last thing I wanted to say is that the people that Trump appointed are extremely pro-Israel. You know, his ambassador to the UN, his, of course, his ambassador to Israel, his secretary of defense, his secretary of state. I mean, every one of them has Israel as a priority. So how do we see peace forward when we see that this administration has appointed people who are blindly pro-Israel? When just a few weeks ago, the ICJ issued arrest warrants to Netanyahu and his defense minister. And they issued also arrest warrants to three of Hamas leaders, Mohammed Deif, Mahaniya, and Sinwar. And the three of these people were killed. Israel killed them, you know? So Israel took its revenge against these people, you know, who the ICJ issued arrest warrant. But now these two other people, Netanyahu and Gallant, are not condemned by the American administration. And this is a very bleak moment in history, I think.
Mossad Abu Tawhid, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was the first time we've had Mossad on Useful Idiots, and very happy to finally speak to him. I'm a big admirer and really appreciate everything he does. His latest poetry book, as we mentioned earlier, is Forest of Noise. Highly recommend it. And thank you to Mossad for joining us to talk about what's happening in his home, Gaza.
We're also excited to bring on for the first time Ramesh Srinivasan, who is a professor of information studies at UCLA and author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow.
Ramesh Srinivasan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron, and thanks, Katie. Thank you both for having me.
The news of the week is DeepSeek. It came out of nowhere. This is a Chinese startup creating a AI that everyone says is even better than ChatGPT at a lot cheaper price. For people who don't know anything about DeepSeek, what should we know about it?
I think first and foremost, people should know that these AI systems, whether it's DeepSeek or OpenAI systems or other systems put out by Google, Gemini, Anthropic, et cetera, are all using our personal data and are using essentially algorithms, which are patterns that are applied to bodies of data to mimic human expression. So none of these systems would be worth a penny or even able to exist without the essential acquisition through essentially a surveillance-based model and the extraction of our personal data, mind you, without any form of compensation or even appropriate disclosure. So that's the most important thing, I think, to note. In terms of the specifics of DeepSeek relative to the Silicon Valley models, the DeepSeek revelations are a revelation because they were essentially able to train and refine their language models based on validated studies I've looked at using open source data and open source input. And this is a big story in the history of the internet and the web. Even big tech companies like Meta tend to profit off of open source input almost never without any form of compensation, but their technologies themselves tend to be closed, you know, as I described on Democracy Now!, walled gardens and sort of invisible silos for behavioral modification, because they tend to feed us content to construct a sense of desire and construct consumption and construct beliefs and therefore divide us in ways that we're barely aware of.
And already we're hearing talk of the Trump administration in response to DeepSeek imposing new tariffs on Chinese on chips, on computer chips for the Chinese market.
Yeah.
Why does the Trump administration see DeepSeek as a threat? And a follow up is like, should normal people like who are not involved in tech, is do you see DeepSeek as a threat to working like average people, or do you see the potential as some tech people do for progress here, for helping with human progress?
I mean, look, it's actually Biden's export ban on the NVIDIA chips. NVIDIA is one of the biggest companies on all of Silicon Valley, a chip maker whose chips are actually powering many of these AI systems, especially the Silicon Valley systems. It was Biden's export ban on those chips that forced this type of resourceful innovation by the Chinese. So if anything, this sort of like closure and kind of this attempt to be nationalist and a duopoly in relation to all these AI and tech is going to leave the US further behind. And it's a silly and sort of navel gazing type of response, in my opinion. It's not going to really help, because here's the key thing with tech. People don't really realize this or recognize this, but it's something I've been studying for about 20 years. Most amazing breakthroughs in tech don't come from just sort of this myth of abundant and infinite resources, abundant and infinite kind of zombie investment capital, what Varoufakis calls techno-feudalism. And now Steve Bannon is literally appropriating that language. He's quoting things that I teach in my PhD courses, literally. So the key thing is, most tech innovation comes, and this is one of the coolest things about tech, and it's always been this case, by kind of putting stuff out there and getting other people's input. And it's always been that. Like a lot of this dates back to hacker and free software and open source culture. So the Chinese just went back to the basics of how almost every major internet technology was formed, which was getting support from the global developer community. So this idea of kind of walling things off and thinking that you're going to win that war is an incredibly retrenched and very naive and infantile idea, and it's not going to work.
Is there anything more like nefarious about China's programs than about America's programs when it comes to data collection? Because that certainly is the narrative that we get from the mainstream media and from US politicians.
Yeah. I've been combing like the CNBC discourse on this, the Fox News discourse on this, and other kind of vantage points. I always do that to kind of understand and survey the landscape. There's no question that Chinese tech platforms, just like tech industries, are built upon intimate surveillance of our lives, or their lives, or maybe the lives of others as well, and the transformation critical point of almost anything and everything into binary integers, into data points. So no question that there's a large scale kind of, you know, Pac-Maning, slurping up of our lives and our data that inform the Chinese large language models, including the DeepSeek model that is kind of taken over the downloads as we speak. But, you know, the thing about the US, as you well know, and I've seen your reporting on this for years, is we like to sort of use a lot of high level moralizing and a lot of this sort of like, well, we have the democratic values and so on. When we know with Silicon Valley, it's clearly evident and it's a bipartisan issue, it's actually a very universally accepted vision that these companies are far from democratic. And yet there's all this kind of hand-wringing about American values. So it just doesn't add up. It's highly sanctimonious and hypocritical. And we've never known on a very intimate level the actual ways in which data are being collected about all of us by American tech companies. That's still never been properly disclosed. And that's the bare minimum that we would need for this to be even close to democratic. We have to start with transparency, move toward accountability, and then the greater state would be more distributed governance. So that's just a long way of saying that we can assume that whether it's American or Chinese, that everything's being collected about us. And we also know, both in China and certainly true in the US, that data can be aggregated. So Katie, it could be your data that's gathered by Instagram about your clicks, your eyeballs, what, et cetera, and this and that. But that data can be aggregated with your credit card record. So sure, I present myself as always having a great time, the coolest person ever on Instagram. But what if that data is aggregated with me buying like 40s and hot dogs and cigarettes and Four Locos after midnight at the local 7-Eleven? That's a different lens into a human's identity. So the point being that we should assume that everything's being monitored at all times and turned into data, digital footprints. And that's what Cambridge Analytica and others did. And we see next to nothing that's actually occurred since all those, since that whole scandal dating back to 2016.
How concerned are you about the usage of natural resources for AI? I recently learned, I couldn't believe this, that for every question you ask ChatGPT, something like a bottle of water is consumed. Is that true? And, you know, how concerned should we be that this like advancement in artificial intelligence comes at the expense of our natural resources, including the most precious one, water?
Yes. These are what we call externalities. So everything from energy resources to the extraction of rare earth minerals, to labor costs, to cooling costs, which is tied to water, to energy costs to power these server infrastructures, which is what this so-called Stargate initiative is. It's just data servers and AI servers and infrastructures. There's massive expenses involved with all of this, including cryptocurrency mining. Note, David Sachs has a very prominent seat in as Trump's crypto czar, right? There's this incredibly intimate marriage we're seeing between big tech oligarchy and the state. So we should be very concerned about it, because the one big issue that kind of really bothers me, and that I see again and again and again, is we as Americans, or just consumers or people more generally, we're never able to appropriately visualize the costs and benefits of almost everything, because everything gets externalized, you know, thrown under the kind of mat. And we only realize how important those what are called externalities are later, right? Like, you narrowly optimize to build up Flint, Michigan, and then you pollute the river. This is a very, to me, it's a very analogous example. So it should be extremely clear what are the costs, financial, environmental, labor, etc., from a planetary vision, because I literally work in parts. I've gone in Congolese rare earth mineral mines and gotten kicked out looking for coltan and cobalt on the Congo-Uganda border, places like that. This is all coming from the earth and from our bodies and from our planet and from our economies, meaning our pocketbooks, for the extraction of value that is often not tied to profitability, but predictions of future valuation. That's why a lot of the tech companies are sort of zombie kind of platforms, because their profitability is not always correlated with their valuation. Amazon, for example, didn't make any money for its first decade. Uber's barely made any money ever. So this is a long, again, sort of, I think all these things are connected. We need to be able to really visualize the costs and benefits of almost every sort of digital interaction that we have. And that's, of course, intentionally designed to be invisible in our lives.
What does that mean that Amazon and Uber haven't made any money?
Well, they certainly make money now, right? And Uber more recently. Amazon didn't make any, was not profitable for at least the first decade of its creation. But while it did that, investors were pumping money into it, and its valuation was quite high. Very similar with Uber. Why? Because of the this is how market cap valuation works. It's all based on predictions of future valuation. So while these companies are busy annihilating any form of competition, you know, getting rid of independent local alternatives, you know, Amazon did that in an expert way. Uber has done that with taxi drivers and other kinds of, you know, sort of transportation possibilities all around the world. While they're doing that, their valuation for the future is increasing. Even if in the present moment, they're not necessarily profitable. And this is why, you know, we sort of see these companies more as feudal platforms, per Yannis Varoufakis and other people's perspective, because they're sort of charging rent, right? Anything you get, Amazon gets a cut of every transaction on it, just like Uber does. These companies, the platforms are in the interest, they're in the business of hiring almost nobody and owning almost nothing. That's quite an amazing business where you have no costs and you just monetize other people's transactions for the so-called efficiency and facility of being able to find an Uber driver. And one other quick thing on this I want to share. I've attended Uber driver strikes and written about it, both as a journalist as well as a scholar, in places like Uganda. And it's a very interesting thing to even think about, what does it mean to strike relative to Uber in Uganda when Uber is 8,000 miles away? It's similar to trying to protest a drone that might drop a bomb on you from, you know, way up in the atmosphere. It's the invisibility of deep pernicious power.
Can you talk about whether there is difference in terms of the consumption, energy consumption? Is there a difference in terms of energy consumption between DeepSeek and other AI models?
Yeah. So look, the key thing with DeepSeek, which is why it's quite a story that's making the rounds and why we've seen this incredible volatility in Silicon Valley valuation just over the last 2-3 days, is because they were able to, for $6 million, train and refine their large language model to basically perform as well as pretty much the latest GPT, you know, which are which is very, very telling. So why were they able to do that? Well, the Biden administration banned the export of NVIDIA chips, which are very, very expensive, to China in an attempt to, because of this sort of silly idea, or maybe it was just a very kind of myopic idea that, okay, this is the way we were able to advance in AI, by using these expensive chips and all these energy costs. So we got to make sure that they can't do the same thing. What they didn't realize is by blocking all those off, this is what people do in all walks of life. When you don't have this or that or the other, you figure out a way to be resourceful, right? So they are using energy costs as well in the Chinese AI examples, but it's not likely to be nearly as much because they're not using the newest NVIDIA chips because they were specifically banned. There's some reports that they managed to steal them or this or that, but that's just standard kind of allegations without much basis. We know there have been IP theft in both directions, actually, in recent years. So Stargate, $500 billion, DeepSeek, $6 million. As it's not exactly apples to apples because the $500 billion includes a number of other kinds of components than just training the large language models. But the Chinese were able to work with stuff that already existed and get input from the open source community and build this model that they've put out on the internet. And I've really been looking at it, and it's remarkable. So the reason why this might sink, at least in the somewhat short term, United States AI application services, is not because it's just or the right thing, but because it's so much cheaper. And because it's so much cheaper, that's where investors are going to go. And that's why I've been seeing what, you know, these CNBC hedge fund guys have been talking about with all this. They're basically like, oh yeah, this is, but I do want to make this point also. This is in the sphere of AI. These AI systems are chatbots that mimic our expression using correlation and using data gathered on us. And they could be the brains of many sort of other kinds of AI systems, whether it's a humanoid robot. Not something I'm that psyched about, but okay, some people might be, or other kinds of IoT systems that are in your house, in your car, maybe in your body, etc. But it doesn't necessarily challenge the underlying reign of big tech and big tech platforms and their near monopolistic, if not monopolistic, status, which are in the business of behavioral futures and behavioral modification. So this doesn't deal with the social media dumpster fire, for lack of a better term. It doesn't mean, and yet again, we're not seeing any robust discussions of actual regulation of these industries as they start emerging. We could do what we didn't do with social media right now, and we could do what we didn't do with Google right now. Those companies were in the process of being regulated right before 9/11 happened. I know that's a long time ago. And then the Patriot Act got shoved down our throats and all those regulations were skirted. Ron Wyden was leading the charge on that back in the day. I was beginning in graduate school at that time.
So what would this look like if we hadn't, submitted to the Patriot Act? What is the regulation that you're advocating? What would that look like?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was great. And definitely check out Ramesh's podcast, the Utopias podcast.
Thank you to Ramesh for joining us. And thank you to you for being here supporting Useful Idiots. You can do that at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, and get bonus content and keep us going so we can continue to give you more great episodes like this, including a classic Useful Idiots doubleheader with two different guests, two different topics. Very informative. And, really appreciate both Ramesh and Wasab for joining us.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.